Well, hello and welcome back to Stats Out of Context. Thanks, everyone, very much for joining us again on this journey through the world of football stats and metrics. Last time out, we took a closer look at the world of assists. And this time around, well, it's usually something that brings up some horrific memories of a certain day at secondary school with splinters, hot glue, and the shouting of my design technology teachers. Again, I'm sorry, Mr. Haynes, I'm sorry. But it's all about woodwork today. And joining me once again, I'm delighted to say, is Duncan Alexander. Duncan, how are we?
Hello, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm just painfully remembering those bad days when I had to go home to my mother with a certain stain on my trousers, and we had to move forward from it very quickly. But to me, there is no greater sound in a football match than that split second of silence after a blistering long-range shot, and then the thud or the clatter as it comes off the post, the bar, followed by the crowd reaction. It's arguably one of the sounds I would actually take with me on something like Desert Island Dish. Sure, it's a little bit of a waste compared to maybe some Coldplay, but probably much more preferable to the ears anyway. But when we look at the history of woodwork in football in the very early days of the sport, and I think this could be a little bit more of a historic journey in this one, there wasn't woodwork when the football started.
No, maybe some wooden legs in medieval football. I mean, this is one of the fascinating things about football, in a sense, is that you get a lot of traditionalists now who are like, well, football didn't start in 1992, it started in 1888, but it didn't start in 1888. It had been going for hundreds of years. You know, Edward III banned football because people weren't practicing their archery. You know, it's important. So we've got hundreds and hundreds of years of football, and we don't really know what it looked like and to your point, what it sounded like. But obviously the 1860s was a big time because that's when it was codified in a couple of places, Sheffield and the public schools of England. They had slightly different interpretations of certain rules around throw-ins and things like that. But yeah, until 1866, there wasn't a top to a goal in football. So you could score a goal at any height, a bit like in Australian rules football. Might be good for someone like Thomas Partey, who tends to, you know, or, you know, Harry Kane's often talked about wanting to go and be a kicker in NFL and, you know, extra points and all that stuff. So, you know, you can see in other codes of football how that kind of rule has lived on, essentially. But yeah, it's funny to think of a game of football where, you know, you couldn't shoot too high, which is good. And then 1866, high tech this, they introduce a tape. So you had the, I imagine a couple of poles marking the width of the goal. And then they taped it at the top. So there was what you could say was a crossbar, but given how heavy those footballs were, especially when they'd picked up a bit of water off the pitch, I imagine the tape wouldn't have lasted too long. And I'm sure, as everyone remembers playing in the park with coats for posts and stuff, I'm sure there were some disputed goals. If you think VAR is bad, then disputing whether the tape, whether the ball went under or over tape might have been harder to see.
I'm also wondering if there were some tricky sort of goalkeepers who sort of, a particularly tall goalkeeper who just reached up and pulled down on the tape as a shot came flying in, rather than, oh, sorry, mate, that's just gone over the bar again. Sorry, I say it's over the tape, lads. Sorry, nothing we can do about it.
Yeah, I mean, I would, you know, people say, what would you do if you had a time machine? Just go back and watch a game of football from 1860s. It would be, I'm sure there'd be lots of elements that would be quite familiar, but it also would look incredibly alien. So yeah, let's move on to 1875. Now you can choose between a crossbar and a tape. So they were like, yeah, we've got this newfangled technology, this stuff called wood, and you can use that if you want, but we know there's a lot of tape traditionalists out there. Football didn't start in 1875. We know that. So I'm sure most clubs based it on how expensive a custom built crossbar slash set of goals was, but they didn't have long to hang on to the tape, because by 1883, it now must be a crossbar. Sorry, tape fans. You're right. Modern football is killing the game, but the, you know, we now have what are recognisably modern goals. And obviously famously, or not that famously maybe, but the dimensions of the football goal haven't changed. Yeah. So an athletic, superhuman, spider-like 9-foot goalkeeper of the modern era basically has to stop the ball going into the same space as a, you know, someone who fought in the Boer War and wears shorts, doesn't wear shorts, rather, wears sort of trousers and has a big moustache. So, you know, there has been talk over the years of adjusting the size of goals, which is obviously poo-pooed by most people because, you know, change is bad. But, yeah. And then I guess the last probable change is the 1902, when the shape and position of the goal, as we've just talked about, kind of creates the liminal space for the penalty area, because that's when they actually draw penalty areas and, you know, 6-yard boxes and things. So, you know, again, the goal, you know, as a kid, if you walk into a football stadium, if you're in a park and you go past, seeing a set of goals just stood there on the grass is quite an emotional thing to see. And it is the kind of, you know, as again, as a kid, if you drew a football pitch, you would draw the goals, wouldn't you? And that would make it into a football pitch. So it's an important thing.
Yeah, and it's always the thing that I always get told whenever there's talk about changes of the laws in the game. And as much as we can obviously mention about the fact that goal line technology 110 years later finally came into what we did there, just 2 years after the tragedy of Frank Lampard, dare we say. But they always talk about any time it comes around to a change in laws, they love this idea that the game that the guys play in the Premier League is exactly the same as the game that you and I can go out on a Sunday club pitch and play. The penalty area is the same, the goal is the same. So they try and make this belief that the games are the same. They're not. And we have to be really bluntly honest and say whatever I played on a Sunday is definitely not what they played on a Saturday in the Premier League. But that idea of, as you say, you can trace the history of the goal all the way back to that time. It's never changed. Some of the goalposts I probably played on as Parks Younger definitely were the goals from the 1900s by the way they were put together. And I can certainly remember one game where the crossbar fell off the top of two posts, which was a real highlight of my junior life as a kid, had to scramble away from the goal. But
also, it's a very minor point, really, but the, as you say there, the change in the shape of goal posts and even the structure of them is important. Obviously, square posts, I think, were the initial ones. And if you think about a shot rebounding off a square post, if it hits it straight on, it's going to come straight back at you. But more likely, it's going to hit the kind of corner of the post. And I imagine, I mean, I'm no scientist here, I'm no John Tickle, but I imagine the angle that it would rebound at would be a lot more random from a square post than from a circular post, which is obviously the current vogue. I don't think triangular shaped posts have ever been a thing. But yeah, and then there's the stanchions, you know, lost to the modern goal. I remember seeing Jason Cousins, a Wickham player, have score a goal. And he hit it so hard, it kind of lodged in the stanchion. So the keeper then had to, not only did he let in a goal, he had to punch the ball out of the curved bit of metal that the net used to hang off. But now, obviously, net technology has moved on
quite a lot. There's that really famous goal of Clive Allen's. I think he was playing for Crystal Palace at the time, where the ball quite clearly goes in. And I have to quote, I think it was Barry Davis on commentary here, where he said it hit the staunchion, not the stanchion, the staunchion. And obviously, no goal line technology at the time. Just a referee with a very long white collar on his shirt, as was the vogue in the 80s, and runs over to one linesman who was nearest the goal. Did it hit the bar? Did it hit the staunchion? Didn't do that. Goes down the other end. And for some reason, went and talked to the other linesman at the other end, who's a good 50 yards away from this coming in and out. And it's only when you really slow down the video that you see that it did actually go in the back of the net and Clive Allen was cheated of a goal. But unfortunately, stanchions, no longer a thing, gone. Along with the days of just holding up a couple of placards and numbers in the air rather than an electronic board and
tape, but let's not forget the tape.
I'm sorry to all the tape fans there. I'm sorry, I've completely mislaid you there.
So moving on to the modern era, or the Premier League era, when football did sort of start, even we do not have complete woodwork data for the history of the Premier League. It's some of it's buried deep in our some of our more obscure databases, but in terms of kind of easy access, like a lot of metrics, we can run it really easily from 2006-07. So that's, let's call that the start of the recorded woodwork era. Obviously, in the 90s and before 2006, there were some very famous woodwork moments. I think Tony Yeboah made it his personal mission to try and score as many goals that rebounded down from the crossbar into there and then back up, which is, again, aesthetically one of the finest things you can see. And then obviously Phil Babb, sadly, made contact with the post at Anfield in quite a quite a unpleasant way. Should we say?
I'm surprised more was not made of that by the commentators at the moment, because it's really that thing when you watch a replay, you go, "Ooh, yeah, that's not a good one, Phil. Don't you don't want to be there?" But he's still going, still churning it around in the lower leagues. The last I saw is at Hazen Yedding as a manager. I seem to remember the last I saw. So still very much on 2 feet, even if he does sing an octave higher these days.
So yeah, let's forward on to 06-07. You know, just pull out some numbers. So in terms of the leaders, I guess, for woodwork hits in since then, since 06-07, it is actually neatly the current big six. it won't surprise people to learn that Liverpool are top on 281, because it does... I think Liverpool and Arsenal probably are the clubs most kind of connected to woodwork hits, if you know what I mean. You can close your eyes and see Steven Gerrard, Xabi Alonso, Van Persie, various others doing it. So yeah, Liverpool 281, then Manchester City on 261, narrowly ahead of Arsenal. I guess City have crept up recently, given, you know, they have a lot of shots now, score a lot of goals, and corollary of that is you know, occasionally hitting the woodwork. And then you get Chelsea on 232. Man United 227 and Spurs on 218. So that's the basic top six by the big six. But it's more interesting, I guess, to look a bit more granular-y. That's not a word, but in a more granular sense. And yeah, the record is 33 by Liverpool in 2011-12, which is an interesting season, because obviously that was the Dalglish season, which Liverpool got to... couple of cup finals, but the league season was pretty disappointing. We touched on it in episode one, actually, about Stuart Downing's incredibly unlucky season. In fact, where he didn't get an assist but created the most chances in the league and didn't score a goal but had the most shots without scoring. He actually, on his debut home to Sunderland, Anfield, cut in from the right flank onto his left foot, let fly with a brilliant chance that hit the crossbar, and maybe then should have realised what sort of season was in store. But yeah, so that's the record, 33. But then Liverpool the second with 27 in 13-14, which as we can all remember, was they scored over 100 goals that season. It was the Suarez, Sturridge, Sterling, Coutinho front four of doom combination. And again, if you're having that many shots, you're going to hit the woodwork.
Indeed. And I think the thing that we should really point out here to everybody as well is that a shot against the woodwork is not a shot on target. Mm. It very much is the definition of a shot off target. It is the most off target shot you can possibly get, because it actually hits the solid boundaries of a world that is not the goal.
Yeah. No. So even now you see on Twitter, you know, like on Opta Joe, there'll be a, this team didn't have a shot on target in this game. And then people go, hang on, they hit the bar or they hit the post. I remember Andy Gray actually saying he wanted to count it as on target because the goal is the target. But the posts, as you say there, Graham, they mark where the target isn't anymore. Yeah. That's like leaving a village in the Midwest and like you are no longer in this town. That's it. That's the post is the start of a whole world where it's not going to be a goal. Yeah. If you type in denied by the crossbar, there's 1.6 million results on Google. So, and I watched some highlights of woodwork hits ahead of this podcast, which was quite enjoyable. And honestly, denied by the woodwork or denied by the crossbar was said by, I reckon, at least 50% of the commentators. So it's very much a phrase, and you can see it sort of makes sense, but in more accurate way, it really doesn't make sense.
I mean, what does make sense sometimes in football? What doesn't make sense sometimes? And we talk about those sort of things. When we look at the player records, I mean, Robin van Persie is the all-time greatest in a single season for hitting the woodwork with 10. And then below that, you've got Luis Suarez with 9 in that 13-14 season, Kevin De Bruyne in 16-17. And then, quite fascinatingly, Harry Kane did this just last season. And of course, Kane was the top scorer and the top assister too. So these numbers could have been even greater if, you know, he was a little bit better at not hitting the woodwork and finding the back of the net a little bit more often.
Yeah, it's interesting actually, because as you point out there, Kane is a recent addition to this list. But you look, so Van Persie, that's when he hit 10, woodwork 10 times, that was 11-12. Suarez 13-14, as we mentioned. De Bruyne 16-17. But it... you know, it does seem like the early 2010s is kind of like the peak for woodwork hits. And that's obviously the very end of the pre-XG era or the start of the XG era. So clubs started using XG behind the scenes secretly, meeting up in lay-bys and chatting expected goals around sort of 2011-12-ish. That was when we first pushed it out to clubs. And we know also that for every season since XG was invented, the average distance of a shot in the Premier League has gone down each season. So it is getting closer. So it's quite interesting to see something essentially as random as hitting the woodwork kind of match that process in a sense. So, you know, players were having more long range shots in the early 2010s. And a result of that was hitting the woodwork more.
And we talk about players doing such things in the early 2010s and the late noughties. I mean, there once was a time Cristiano Ronaldo played at the Valley. I know it's hard to believe, but this did happen. Cristiano once did have to go to South London and play there. And this is a prime example, a big old shot of his. He hit it the woodwork so hard with it that this ball rebounds, what, 30, 35 yards out before it even lands on the ground again. And I think that's just the way... as you say, XG and such like and analytics as a whole are beginning to influence even back then. And as much as people say, oh, modern football being ruined, modern football isn't the late noughties 2010. It very much is just that development that teams are going, hang on here. Yes, it's great when we ping the post and you get the crowd on your side. But if we maybe work that chance a little better, take 2-3 yards more on it, there's actually more chance that we're actually going to get, one, the shot on target, and two, the shot will actually more likely convert into a goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And you look through some of the classics of that era. You know, there's a Roy Keane one, the Kop End at Anfield. You know, smashes off the crossbar, and the commentator says only the crossbar denies Roy Keane his 50th goal for Manchester United. Well, maybe the crossbar did, or maybe it's not a sentient being, and it was actually the, you know, Roy Keane's shot selection that had more of an influence. I don't know. I'm not an expert.
I meant to say, have you seen the Roy Keane crossbar challenge from his time as Ireland coach?
No.
So Roy Keane does it. I mean, we're only talking about 25 yards out here, but Roy Keane hits a beautiful little chip onto the crossbar, and the way the trajectory of the ball, it rolls directly back to his feet. That is the ultimate crossbar challenge. You ping it off the angle of the crossbar precisely so that it just rolls back to you. No movement, no chasing after the ball.
And you know as well that Keane will have, you know, given short shrift to even the concept of a crossbar challenge. So, I mean, in a sense, actually, that's an interesting point because, you know, crossbar challenge did arise around this time as well. And I think there is almost a kind of late 2000s, early 2010s fetishization of hitting the woodwork. It became, like you said at the start, the sound of it, just the aesthetics of it, just smashing in a shot from long range that kind of loops down. It does sort of look better than it going in the back of the net, really. that's why I think the Yeboah goals where they hit the crossbar, bounce down and bounce up, really, that is the kind of peak of finishing because it just looks so good. And yeah, maybe the kind of decline in popularity of the crossbar challenge, I mean, I'm basing this anecdotally, but it seems like, you know, again, that's come at the same time as the rise in cherishing shooting from closer range and understanding and validating accuracy a bit more than, you know, thumping shots.
So we're going to have to mourn not only the loss of tapes for goalposts, we're now going to have to, and crossbars, we're going to have to mourn the loss of the thumping long-range shot because it's not going to happen.
They're killing the game, Graham. They're killing the game. But just having a look back through some of the woodwork stats that we've got, and it occurred to me that we know everyone knows about Brighton in recent seasons, you know, with the expected goals narrative last year where, you know, they'd have been in the top six if they, you know, if they'd have defended and attacked a bit better, a bit more accurately. But that game they lost in September 2020 at home to Manchester United, they lost 3-2. Most people remember that they lost to a goal in after the final whistle, which is the only time I've ever seen that happen. So the final whistle went, VAR recommended that United got a penalty, which they duly dispatched. But lesser remembered from that game is that Brighton set a record for number of times hitting the woodwork in a single game, which was 5 times. So, I mean, if you're kind of listing unlucky performances, 5 woodwork hits in a game and then losing to a goal after the final whistle is certainly up there. Although, incredibly, a few months later in February 2021, Brighton became the first Premier League team to miss 2 penalties with both hitting the woodwork. And that was away at West Brom. So they, yeah, that Brighton season, I think people kind of accept it was unlucky now. But I think when you remember the actual details of how unlucky they were, it is extraordinary.
Ah, dearie me. And I'm sure Brighton fans. But if we're talking about the unluckiest of seasons, we have to go back to the 2015-16 campaign and Arsenal. If some magical rule happened, now I played in this 6-a-side tournament as a kid, and I can remember this. Not going to mention any towns, but it was definitely the Aldershot Town tournament. And they had this bizarre point scoring system where a win in a tournament was, if you had a goalless draw, it was 2 points. If you had a gold draw, it was 3 points. And if you had a win, it was 4 points. But they also did this magical thing where they gave you a point for every corner. So as a result, you saw we developed this tactic where we just took the ball down into the corner and just kept hitting it off the defender's leg and just racking up. We were losing games 2-1, but winning on corners. It was absolutely bizarre. So we need to sort of imagine this in your head, that we go back to the 2015-16 season and we turn around and we go, you know what? If a shot's hitting the woodwork, we'll actually count them as goals. Well, there would have been a very different league champion, and who knows? Arsene Wenger might have had another 10 years in charge of Arsenal if this had come off.
Yeah, I mean, that season, both Arsenal and Tottenham should have, you know, can probably sit down and think we probably should have won the league that year. I mean, the fact Leicester did show that there was a real tailing off from the traditional challengers. But as you say, yeah, if woodwork hits a counter goals, Arsenal would have won the league. I remember we pushed that out and up to Joe. And if you start any bit of information with the word "if," then you're unleashing forces based around, well, if my auntie had etc., then should be, so on and so forth. But the point is, it's just a different way of looking at the data. And yeah, what does that tell us? It tells us that, you know, Arsenal were close to winning the league, which I guess we knew. It tells us that Arsenal were a team that hit the woodwork a lot, which we've discussed. I think that's fair enough. And it also tells us that it's a stupid idea and that the net's there for a reason. But yeah, in some ways, I think we'd pushed out a few years before the woodwork hit league table. And it was one of the first kind of bits of sort of data meme, I guess, in the sense that it went quite big quite quickly on social media, because people, you know, if you're an Arsenal fan, you're like, yeah, that's good. If you're not, then you're like, yeah, it's stupid. But it's the same reaction, essentially. So yeah, I mean, that was a kind of early example of what we see a lot now. We see it, you know, and it's getting more advanced now. We can actually obviously, you know, plug players into different teams and see how they might get on in the future rather than just looking retrospectively. So, you know, maybe we'll get to the point where we can say, look, if you ban shooting from outside the box, you're going to get 8 more points and win the league. But would a player adhere to that when the pressure of shooting is upon them?
And of course, like, we have to say that woodwork has helped bring into focus maybe the, I'm going to put it in inverted commas, greatest invention in modern football, which is VAR. And we mentioned it very briefly earlier, but after that Frank Lampard double hit in against Germany, the immediate cries for goal line technology and further additions of technology into the game really brought it, I thought, into sharp focus. And so woodwork does have, for some, we talk about other things that just have ruined, again, in inverted commas, bringing the quote marks out a lot this week, but ruined modern football. Woodwork's got a lot to answer for, especially the fact that it's no longer wood.
Well, yeah, we call it woodwork. It's not been wood for a long time. It's the clang of metal now. So, yeah, I wonder when the big wood to metal transfer went. Probably, I don't know, I'm saying 60s, probably, 70s. But, yeah, I mean, obviously, the Lampard thing did bring in Hawkeye, which, by and large, it confused Jonathan Pearce at the 2014 World Cup, famously, but by and large has been a fairly seamless system compared to VAR, I would say. But there obviously was that instance, was it the first game of the lockdown?
Correct, yeah. Sheffield United, wasn't it? I seem to remember.
Aston Villa, yeah. And it got Villa a point, which ultimately, you know, helped them to stay up, although Villa fans would point out that it wasn't the sole reason. You know, they would have stayed up without that point, but it did, you know, shift things slightly. Project Restart was rocked by a Hawkeye sensation. But yeah, by and large, it's a system that's worked well. I mean, we're used to, I think there was a season Liverpool and City were both going for the title, both got into the 90 points. Was that 18-19? The big match at the Etihad around January time, there was the goal line clearance from, was it Laporte or John Stones? One of them. And I think that's the closest I've seen. Yeah. It was basically, and as we know, as we hear people shout at any kids game, the whole of the ball, the whole of the line. And I mean, it was a couple of millimetres from being a goal, I would say. But it's interesting, your point, because I think people seem to accept the goal line truth as it stands, you know, compared to a VAR offside or whatever. There does seem to be a pretty wide acceptance of this technology. And I guess it has helped. You know, there's other examples in Premier League history. We're straying from woodwork here, but there was a Bolton goal against Everton that was ruled out that didn't cross the line back in the 90s. That did relegate Bolton. If they'd have got the points in that game, they would have stayed up. So, you know, big things can revolve around these things. That's why this technology comes. That's what people forget, isn't it? That recent VR didn't just emerge. It emerged because everyone was complaining about referees. So
I mean, you can date it all the way back to the famous phantom goal between Watford and Reading, just to mention that for our colleague Matt Furness there, just to mention that goal, the goal that never was, the goal that didn't go between the woodwork, but still counted as a goal.
More of a vibe than an actual goal, but you know. Oh, it's
similar to the vibe that you sort of see this these days with kids and sort of growing up. Definitely it was the old jumpers for goalposts very much. There is now this absolute desire for kids to have goalposts in the back garden. And you can't, I mean, by all means, there's a house around the corner from me where there's this wonderful old world drawn out goal in front of the house, which has very quickly been replaced by a set of goalposts because I think the residents are a little bit sick of seeing the crockery come off the wall every time the ball thuds in.
There's an excellent Twitter account called Urban Goals, which is just photographs of goals in urban scenarios generally, surprise, surprise. But there's some superb, you know, painted goalposts against garage doors or, you know, even, some really good ones. That's worth checking out. But yeah, I mean, there is something magical, as we said at the start, I think it's a good way to finish maybe, about the football goal. You know, the kind of the care that groundsman puts into to hang the net off it. I mean, I actually once got to take down the Cranbridge United nets at the end of a season in the 2000s because I was hanging around for work reason, and the groundsman just said, "Can you give me a hand?" And I was like, "All right." Followed him onto the pitch, and there on a lovely early summer's late spring evening, the birds tweeting. Before the only people tweeting in those days, I think. and me and the groundsman just slowly unclipped the net from the goals at Abbey Road Stadium. And it was, yeah, quite a pleasant moment, that.
From tweeting to truths, I think, is the phrase we have to use these days.
Yeah.
And, of course, we're just going to round it up very neatly. The woodwork still plays an important role. Just the weekend gone, we saw the completion of a perfect hat-trick from Raheem Sterling because he decided that the best thing to do is put a penalty onto the post and then so he could roll it home with his left foot. I mean, that's where woodwork is now causing assists. That's what we want to see.
Well, I mean, you know, we've seen players try and do the penalty where you pass it to a teammate. Sometimes it works. Sometimes, brackets, Arsenal, it doesn't work. I mean, I want to see a player who's so accurate that he can, if he doesn't want to clog up his goal scoring stats with penalties, just do what Sterling did, but deliberately just roll against the post and then tap in the rebound. It's because that doesn't count as a penalty. So make you look like a much better forward than you maybe are.
I think it is best, though, that we go back to that moment at Abbey Road Stadium. We remember the day Duncan took down the goalpost at the end of the season. A truly heroic image to sort of end and take away from this podcast, I feel, because it doesn't get much better than that. Football and goalposts, it has to be said, the woodwork does stir emotions in a way that maybe it doesn't others. Duncan, thank you very much for joining me again this week. That was a great fun journey, that was.
Thank you. I'm just off to the shop to buy some tape. I'm going to make tape back my ambition for 2022.
Maybe it's going to make a big comeback, and in 100 years' time, when sadly we're probably both long gone, but the guys that are the analysts in the future are going to be talking about this era of, do you remember the crossbar era? Now that we're back in the tape era, who knows? That's the dream. Duncan, thank you very much for joining me. I hope you have enjoyed that journey with us once again. You can join all the great podcasts that we have here from the analysts on our podcast feed, which is The Reach from the Analyst, which you can find on all your favourite podcast applications like Apple, Google, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, the works. We are across the board. And if you have enjoyed this, don't forget to head as well to theanalyst.com, the home of data-driven storytelling. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to rate, review, and tell your friends all about us. We can't wait to bring you the next episode, which will be in the can very shortly. But from Duncan and I, until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.